Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We're the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Movie Crush, Friday interview edition. And I'm sitting on a Zoom screen across from Dan Taberski, writer and filmmaker and podcaster. And I think maybe the best way to describe you is just storyteller. Is that fair?
Sure.
You like that?
Yeah, it's okay. Documentarian. How about documentarian?
Okay, that's good.
Yeah.
Which is storyteller, not to nitpick, but, you know.
Look. You're really hung up on the storytelling thing.
It's good to meet you. We just met like 30 seconds ago. So
yeah, right on.
I learned you have small ears and that you hate storytellers.
Totally. That's all you need to know, folks.
Where are you from, Dan?
New York, originally born in Queens.
Okay.
Archie Bunker territory, yeah.
And now you're in Brooklyn, is that right?
Right now I'm in Brooklyn, but I live in Manhattan.
I'm kind of curious about your... I like to talk to guests about the movies of their youth and sort of what kind of impact that had on them as future entertainers or even if it did. And was that something that, were you sort of a movie obsessed kid or?
I was not. Isn't that funny? I was, it never occurred to me to do, to sort of make any sort of art, until well into adulthood.
What was your track?
I studied public policy in college.
So I
worked in politics for a while. I worked at the White House for 2 years right out of college, and then went into journalism from there. So I started in politics, which I quickly realized was not for me.
Now, which White House did you work in?
Oh, it's the Clinton White House. I was the assistant to the president's economic advisor.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Wow.
It was crazy. Yeah, it was really hard and really intense. And I answered a lot of phones.
Uh-huh.
And it was like thrilling, but like incredibly difficult work.
Now, and I've spoken to another couple of people, including recently someone who worked in politics for a while, where you're how did you go into that? Was it eyes wide open? And I don't mean to say naive, but were you kind of smacked in the face with the reality of the situation?
No, I understood pretty well the politics of it and politics and compromise and all that stuff. What I didn't understand is that being political and working in politics required you to be political on a personal level too. So it required you to collect people.
Mm-hmm.
Collect friends, it required you to really be outgoing and always thinking about what relationships can do for you and help you to move things forward. And I don't even begrudge people who do that. It's just not the way I think. And so I found that part to be a real slog. Like, I'm not social enough in the simplest terms. I just don't want that many friends.
So was it a pretty quickly realized thing that, like, I'm not going to go far in this world because I can't play that game?
It was, I joined the Clinton administration in 95 and I stayed through the election in 96, okay. Understanding that it was a super literal, like, you know, there aren't many things that one does that feels like an honor, but it really does feel like that to walk in the White House every day.
Yeah.
Or at least it did for me. And so I, you know, the experience of doing that was great, but I sort of knew that I didn't have what it took to sort of be successful.
And that was right out of college, so early 20s?
It was my first job out of college besides Pizzeria Uno. I was a waiter at Pizzeria Uno. Okay. Yeah.
Where did you go from there, career-wise?
And then I moved to New York, and I worked at NBC News for 2.5 years, mm-hmm. Or 3 years. And then from there, I went to The Daily Show. So I sort of had a brief dalliance with actual news, and then my job quickly became making fun of the news of The Daily Show, and it sort of stayed in that sort of meta place.
Now, was that with John Stewart? Was that still mm-mm. Okay?
It was right when John started. It wasn't with Craig Kilborn. He had left, and so I pretty much started when John started.
Wow, that's cool. I've had a bunch of Daily Show people on the show.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, now that I'm kind of...
Oh, yeah, you had Elliot Kalin, right?
I had Elliot on. I've had, John Hodgman's a pal of mine, so he's been on a few times.
Yeah, he's great.
And I'm trying to think, it seems like Dan from The Flophouse has been on.
What's The Flophouse?
The Flophouse is Elliot's movie show.
Oh.
Yeah, he has the movie podcast, a bad movie podcast. Where he and his pals talk about a bad movie. It's pretty funny. Dan McCoy. I don't know why Dan's slipping, because Dan's a friend of mine too.
Oh, okay. And I don't know who that is.
I had Wyatt on. Mm-hmm. Wyatt Cenac.
He was after my time.
Yeah. And I've been trying to get Chad Carter's an old friend that I've been trying to get on. And I think Chad probably came on after you too.
If he's an old friend, why won't he come on your show?
It's been a minute, and I think the pandemic kind of screwed everything up for a while.
I'm just wondering if you're sort of judging the friendship.
No, it's great. Chad's awesome. What was The Daily Show like? Were you producing segments?
I was a producer, yeah. Mm-hmm. So I would travel around with the correspondents and direct and write the segments with them.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah, super fun and thrilling and often scary because, you know, very often you're fooling people.
Right.
And so that was early Daily Show days where people really didn't, for the most part, people didn't really know what it was. And they didn't sort of realize it until you're in the middle of it. So there's always like a light switch moment where they're like, oh, this is a joke.
Right. And that could get, dicey.
Yeah. Every once in a while. Yeah. It gave me faith in people. Like 95% of the time, people think it's great. Mm-hmm. People think it's funny, and they totally people have good senses of humor. And just as long as you're not taking them down for no reason,
right?
But you're sort of the joke. The target of the joke is something else besides them personally. Yeah. Like I'm always surprised at how people sort of are happy to be part of a larger joke.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah.
So in 2014, you really kind of. I think turned the podcast world on its ear with Missing Richard Simmons.
17.
Oh, was it 17? Mm-hmm. What did I say? 14?
Yeah. 2014 was Serial.
Yeah. That turned the podcasting world on its ear too.
Yeah.
2017, which, you know, what were your expectations for that show? Did you think it was going to blow up like it did?
No, I thought it was, no, my gosh, no. I mean, no. It just seemed like the small, it was like a small thing.
Yeah.
That like, you really don't have any reason why people would listen to it, really, if that makes any sense. And it felt like it felt like a gesture that I was doing about this person that I thought was really important and special, Richard Simmons. But once we started to put it out, it sort of attracted people in a way that we didn't expect. And then you realize you're sort of part of something that isn't really yours anymore.
Yeah, it was really something else. I mean, it was, it blew up in a really big way. And
yeah,
I imagine gave you sort of all the currency you needed in this new medium or newish medium for you, I guess, to sort of do whatever you wanted as a documentarian from that point.
I mean, short answer, yeah, kind of. Yeah. It did feel that way. Like it felt like it had touched something, and it either maybe people either loved it or hated it, which I think is sort of an interesting place to be.
Right.
It means you're tweaking something, uh-huh. right? Like you're sort of flicking people's ears in a way that sort of makes people stand up a little bit.
Yeah.
And so it definitely gave me the opportunity to work with really good people after that and continue to, people would take chances on sort of weird ideas, and mm-hmm. it's a great place to be. I love doing it. It's amazing to have people take chances on weird ideas.
Yeah. And I think it was, you know, as someone who's been doing this in my 13th year or so, it's interesting to see ideas come around that really shift the landscape of the industry. And I think Missing Richard Simmons was definitely one of those. And you can always tell when, you know, podcasts are so quick to market, and that's one of the cool things about this medium is you can get something out the door really fast, you know, unless it's super sort of long game research heavy, but then you can still sort of start telling that story if you want to. And so that's a cool thing. But the weird part about that is that it lends itself to a lot of copycat material and content. I think Missing Richard Simmons is one of those, which is a compliment, but like it comes out and then I feel like a lot of people were like, oh my God, like what's our Missing Richard Simmons? Like and maybe even sometimes as base of an idea is like, who can we go out and try and find who has seemingly disappeared?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that
which
happened.
Is a scary impulse.
Yeah.
Like you don't want people doing that. Like that's not like we took a big we were really deliberate in how we went into that project, mm-hmm. and I had enough information and enough contact with the people who close to Richard and the people involved in his life that I had certainty about things that I think we were just very we went into it very wide open and very considered,
right.
And I think we walked a fine line for sure. Mm-hmm. But very often you hear like, what happened to this guy? I get missing Britney Spears tweets all the time.
Oh yeah.
Like people want to know like, Dan, go find Britney Spears. And I'm like, she's fine.
Right.
I don't need to find, like, isn't she in Las Vegas or something? Like people have a real sense of like that it's not something, I don't think it's something I would ever do again. So it was just that person in that situation. It's definitely not a model. I've been asked to sort of recreate that model.
That was going to ask that. I'm sure
it's not even something. I mean, if it comes up, I guess, but like, it's not, it would never happen again because I was the only reason I did that is because I knew Richard Simmons and I was taking his class for a year and a half and it was, I was sort of involved mm-hmm. in that world. And so I was much, much, much less of an outsider than like a normal documentarian would be. I don't think I would ever have the courage or the balls to like to do something like that if I was just coming in from the outside and parachuting in.
Yeah. Another show that you've done, which I have yet to listen to, which I'm putting at the top of my list, is Running from Cops.
Mm-hmm.
Because Cops is a show that I never knew when it came on. It was Cops mm-hmm. was one of those shows that seems like it was always on. But if you were someone who flipped around a television dial, then you would run into it. And I felt like I ran into it a lot, enough to watch it
sure
a lot.
Did. Yeah.
Without being someone who was like, oh, it's whatever night at whatever time. I got to check out Cops.
Yeah.
And it's a show that I feel bad for watching so much now through today's lens when I was, you know, younger and in my 20s. And I was never like, rah, rah, this is awesome, man. Like, you know, what they're doing. It was just, there was something about it, the spectacle of it, I was definitely into, and I would love to know a little bit more about this project.
Yeah, I mean, that was the point of the project is that I estimate that I've seen maybe 500 episodes of Cops, and this is before the show. I mean, I just watched it. I'm somebody who grew up watching television as background noise, and so I'm used to having something on, and And Cops is like perfect. It's on. At the time it was on 15, sometimes 20 times a day.
Okay. No wonder I ran into it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. So your senses do not lie. It literally is on all the time. And there is something, as far as reality shows go, there was the sense that you really are watching something real. Mm-hmm. That had elements of realness to it that other reality shows don't have. And they also, they're training their cameras on a world that you don't see, that you don't really see in other reality shows. Like, these are working class, poor neighborhoods, mm-hmm. and people who aren't usually sort of featured in a way that you could sort of hear or see about them. But then, of course, you realize, like, it's, and so the project was to explore that show. We watched and analyzed and cataloged 847 episodes, I think it was. Wow. And just sort of trying to figure out how real is Cops? What is it we were actually seeing? Uh-huh. It's an incredibly fucked up show that does incredibly fucked up things to the people who are on it. I have a complicated relationship to that show, but it was an analysis to exactly what you said. Like, why am I watching this? And how are they doing it? Like, how are they allowed to, how is it put together, and who's actually like sort of consenting to be a part of it?
Right.
And the answers to that are pretty intense.
Oh man, I can't wait to listen to this.
Oh good. It's so good. Sorry. I shouldn't say that about my own work, but I'm so proud of it. And for if you're interested in the show, it's just like about the history of policing on television and reality shows and how it intersects with actual criminal justice and what you actually think is true versus not. And it's been on for 30 years. And the influence it has, not just on reality shows, but on policing, like literally cops become cops because of what they see on Cops. And so the behavior that they're mimicking is the things that reality shows are telling them to mimic. It's sort of an incredible long-term experiment that has gone horribly wrong.
Yeah. I'm going to be diving into that soon for sure. I want to talk to you about The Line too. Now is it currently still in production?
There were 6 episodes. Okay, the last episode aired a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, early May. Where did this story come from? And where do your stories come from generally? Is it just literally whatever piques your interest?
Running from Cops was my idea. Missing Richard Simmons was my idea. And then I sort of found partners and collaborators to sort of make it with. The Line was actually the first one that wasn't my idea.
Oh, okay.
It was brought to me by Apple and Alex Gibney, the director. Mm-hmm. And they asked me if I would be interested in sort of tackling this. And I just kind of spent a month looking back at the Eddie Gallagher trial. It's about the Navy SEAL Eddie Gallagher and the war crimes trial that he was involved in. But it also just becomes much larger about forever wars and what it is that we're asking people to do when they go out and fight covertly, especially in the way that wars have been fought in the past 20 years since 9/11. Mm-hmm. And so it just becomes a much larger look at, what is the line between combat and war crimes?
Right.
And what is our complicity in that? So fascinating. Intense. We talked to over 50 special operators, Navy SEALs, who are incredibly unusual people. Mm-hmm. People who can do what they do and people who have experienced the things they experience, regardless of any of the politics around it. It is just fascinating. It's a fascinating sort of dive into that world.
Yeah, it's interesting in that you like with Stuff You Should Know, I feel like we covered these short, broad overviews of topics, and we've done a couple of thousand of them at this point. So it's a lot of stuff, but it's, we're always treading in sort of the shallowest waters because of the nature of the show. You know, it's, we got to spit something out in 45 minutes, which is a good overview, and you get to really dig in there. And I'm jealous in a lot of ways that of that kind of deep dive journalism. It's something that really has always interested me. And I found myself, and I love what I do with Stuff You Should Know, but, I feel like, the grass is always greener, I think, in this
totally,
case.
100%.
But I could also see, when you're living and breathing this stuff, that must get tough sometimes.
Yeah, it was a dark year. I had started doing this project, and then the pandemic came, and so then I ended up doing it all from my attic soundproofed room.
Right.
And it's pretty heavy. It's very, very, very heavy. And you're talking to people who you're not just hearing about intense things. You're talking to the people who experience them, and they're telling you where their heads are at now, and they're allowing you in that sense. It's incredibly heavy, but also like you spend all this time talking to these people, and then you really do have tools to look at a story and a situation and the world in that specific world in a really complete way, and have confidence to sort of make assessments and actually here's what I think is going on. And so it really is a process of like just trying to understand. It's great. But I agree, the grass is always greener. I would love, every once in a while, I was just thinking, boy, I would love to just talk about something different every week.
Right.
And just, you know, but that is not where I ended up.
When do you know? I feel like we have some listeners who probably either have interest in making documentaries or have done so themselves, and it's something that might interest me, you know, on down the line in the future. And I think you tell stories so well, and I've always wondered when you know that you're done. Does that make sense? Like, when do you know that you have told the story in as complete a way as you desire?
Well, in no small part is because of the deadlines that you set and that other people set for you. And that is important, to sort of put a cap on it,
right?
I think, 'cause you could really spend forever. For me, it's, this is going to sound really dippy, and I don't usually sort of express this verbally, but well, who cares? It's sort of like, you think about it like you're investigating a feeling, like the Eddie Gallagher story and the story of Eddie Gallagher and the story of the SEALs and the story of war. It made me feel a certain way. I really couldn't decide how I felt about it. And I felt like I was seeing something that other people weren't expressing, and that once you can get that feeling out of your head and into sort of like 5 hours of audio, and that it sort of reflects what was in your head, then that to me is done. I'm not even really thinking about the listener as I'm making it. I'm more thinking it like, is this what I'm thinking?
Right.
And there's something that feels complete about just like, okay, I can put it away now because here's how I feel about it. Even if you don't come up with answers, and I rarely do, there are rarely answers. But just the exploration of it, to have that feeling with the music and the people you talk to and the writing you do around it and all that stuff, if it feels all together in a composite like that feeling that's in your head, then you're done.
That's not dippy. I think that's a great answer.
All right, good. Thanks.
What's next? Can you talk about it, or do you got some ideas that you have tucked away?
I'm working on something right now that will come out in a couple months that I can't, I guess I can't really talk about it now. But I think it's going to be good.
Great.
I'm knocking on wood if you can hear that. Yeah. I hope.
Fantastic.
I have great partners. Yeah. So it's going good.
That's awesome. I bet that's fun too, to work with different people on different projects. And, you know, I used to work in the film industry, so I sort of miss the days of putting together a crew of people and doing a thing that lasts a certain amount of time and then graduating from that and moving on and working with new great people.
Yeah, and then having them, like, the whole, I mean, it's so interesting to talk about my work in these situations, but then to be working with people who are just, it really is a collaborative process in a really great way, like, that you can just let go of parts of it and let other people, let their opinions and sort of inform the project. And I really like that part. If you have the right partners, it's really satisfying.
Amazing.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, so when I sent you the email, our buddy Mangesh got us together, which is very great. Mm-hmm. Mangesh is such a good person and good connector of people.
Yeah.
You sent me a few movies, including one that I did not get to watch that I can't wait to see, though, the documentary about the unearthed film.
Oh, Dawson City, Frozen in Time.
Yeah, I can't wait to see this.
Oh, it's so incredible. It's basically a documentary about a town in the Yukon, and the sort of, they found a trove of old movies that almost all of them are gone except for those prints that they had buried in the ground and that had preserved because it was so cold up there. And it's just it's a look at the growth of this town, Dawson City, and at the same time using those old film clips to sort of illustrate that history. There's no words, it's only text on screen, but it's just one of those films that gets, it feels like it can see the whole world. Like you feel like you can see everything for a second in and it's just I love it. I love it. I like practically stalk that guy. Like I talk about that movie way more than is appropriate.
Well, I can't wait to see it. I think I feel bad that I chickened out a little bit because it was a movie without dialogue, and I have a feeling once I'll see it, I'll probably email you again and say,
so.
"Hey,
it's
you
really
want to come
moving.
Back on and we'll talk about it?"
Yeah. It's really moving and stuck with me still to this day.
But what I did jump on was the 1988 Mike Nichols film Working Girl, because it's a movie that I somehow never saw. It's one of those movies that I felt like I saw because I knew the plot and it was such a big hit. And the only thing I can figure out is that I was 17 and it's not a real 17-year-old kind of movie.
No.
It's a movie for adults and they used to make those at one point.
Yeah, isn't that funny? You can't, it doesn't fit anywhere right now.
I know. I talk about that a lot, like adult films and how they just used to make more mature content. And movies for people that are 30 and up. But I watched it today for the first time, and I loved it. It was so great.
Isn't it great?
It really is.
I just couldn't love it more.
What's your experience? When did you see it first? Just what's your background?
I was thinking about that today. I actually saw it in the theater, which is strange because I think I was like 16. If it was 88, I was 15,
okay.
Which is why is a 15-year-old seeing this movie? but I remember I saw it in the Quad on Northern Boulevard in Queens.
Uh-huh.
I remember seeing it. I remember, and the reason I remember is because we were such little shits. I remember back then we would like sit in the back of the theater and like try to smoke cigarettes, mm-hmm. like as if nobody's gonna know, right? Or like, yeah. So stupid.
You can smell someone smoking a cigarette from 50
feet
away.
Yeah, like it's not going to fucking bother everybody. Yeah. Like, and that you wouldn't care. Uh-huh. And so I do remember watching it then, but that wasn't where my love for it. My love for it sort of came later as one of those films that just appeared on television a lot.
Yeah.
And so again, like as somebody who likes television, this has changed, but I'm not a big Netflix person. I'm not a big iTunes person. I like television. And when it's on, I want to catch it.
Yep.
And I'll watch it from the middle. I want to watch something that I feel like other people are watching. There's something about that.
Oh, interesting.
That I like. Yeah, isn't that weird? I like the commercials. Uh-huh. I like that. And Working Girl is sort of a usual suspect for that. And it's just such a great movie. It's so well done.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I almost had to avoid seeing this movie because it is one of those sort of HBO specials that ran forever on HBO.
Yeah.
It was fun today to see a little bit of a blast from the past, just as far as the, you know, the styles and the hair. And high school that I was looking at, you know, it was every girl I know, their senior picture was Joan Cusack's hair.
With the big hair. Right? Yeah. Isn't that incredible?
It was amazing.
And it's so funny. If you look back at that movie now, it reads like a parody, like because it's all the secretaries. It reads like that they're doing their hair super big because they're trying to be funny.
Right.
And like as if they were doing like a movie making fun of 20 years before. And it's not. They're making fun of that time.
Yeah.
That is what people looked like.
Yeah. That's exactly
that was
what
the style.
Think. Yeah.
It was fantastic. It was fantastic. Yeah. I had friends like that too. Oh, the hair.
Yeah.
Barbara.
It's pretty great.
Forget her. Yeah.
Mike Nichols to me is, I hesitate to call him underrated because he's gotten like lifetime achievement awards. He's certainly not undervalued or underrated, but I do feel like his name should come up more when you're talking about best directors of all time, when you look through his filmography. And I think one reason is because he sort of disappears into his work in the best way not a director should, because I also love auteurs who are like, hey, this is a Paul Thomas Anderson movie and you know it from the second you sit down. But I do love that Mike Nichols is not showy and that he's not interested in making it about himself.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it doesn't feel you can't see him at all, especially in this movie, because the characters are like Sigourney Weaver, Melanie Griffith, and Harrison Ford, like just all three of them are just like, they're almost like cotton candy. Like they're just like, it is just so about them.
Yeah.
In a great way. And so, he seems like he puts all of his focus on highlighting them.
He does. And I think his stories that he tells are so human. Like that always seems to be the common element to me for a Mike Nichols film is there about people. And
what other films are you thinking of?
Well, I mean, certainly The Graduate. I think I love Biloxi Blues. Of course, that's a Neil Simon jam, so that's got its own sort of specific tone to it.
Mm-hmm.
What other movie? I was looking through
his... there?
Here, I'm typing real quick. I don't usually do this.
Who did Ishtar?
It was not Mike Nichols.
Because I want to fucking talk to that guy. I've never actually seen Ishtar.
I think I haven't either. And I do have a friend and kind of repeat guest who wants to talk about Ishtar. So I'm going to take him up on that at some point.
Apparently, it's not as bad as everybody says.
That's what I've heard. He did Silkwood.
Oh, Silkwood is so good.
Great movie.
You can't see that movie now.
Oh, is it not available?
You can't see it on Amazon. You can't. I've tried many times.
You got to go to the video.
Because I always want to see Cher playing a lesbian. Like,
right.
I love that whole thing. And the scrubbing scene. And like, I like to just watch movies that I've seen before and they you can't get it anywhere. It's really frustrating for me.
I think.
I got upset.
You've bound to be able to rent it, right? If you find your.
You cannot.
Oh, it's not
I
even on.
I defy you to find Silkwood.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can't rent it. You can't rent it on Amazon, iTunes. It's not on Netflix. You can't get it.
No, but physically, no? Can you go to a video store? Like, there's still video stores. We got a great one in Atlanta.
Well, dude, if that counts. Is like, yeah, like I can take out my projector.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I'm talking about reasonable ability.
Yeah. All right. Good point. He did Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in the 60s.
Yeah.
And he doesn't have a feeling as a director, though, I think. He's not one of those people that has like a, a genre that he sticks to. He's done kind of some crazy things over the years that he just sort of disappears into.
Yeah.
And I think he's an EGOT winner.
What did he win? Was it for The Graduate? Did he win his O?
I think he won the O. And I'm not sure about the EG and the T either, but he is in.
I believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The great Mike Nichols. Great cast in this movie. It's just sort of stacked, and it's kind of fun to go back and see young Oliver Platt and Kevin Spacey just way overacting in his one scene, to an obnoxious point.
Well, he's playing an obnoxious person.
He did it well.
Yeah. Kudos to you, Kevin Spacey.
Yeah, snorting cocaine and drinking champagne. It was pretty bad.
Totally. Apparently, Melanie Griffith was doing cocaine all through that movie. Did you read about that?
No.
I just did a quick little wiki.
Yeah.
Whatever. Apparently, there was a whole thing. Like she's talked about it, that like she had basically had a cocaine problem at the time, and there was a point where she came in. This is a story that I'm assuming that this is a quote from her, so I'm assuming it's true. That she came in high on coke and they shut down the set.
Oh wow!
They said this was like she was a young actress. Like this is not. They shut it down because of her. And Mike Nichols took her to breakfast the next morning and said, "Here's the deal. We're not going to tell anybody about this. You're paying for the cost of what we had to shut down."
Wow!
And she did it.
Holy
and
cow! Apparently,
yeah, and she said it was a real lesson for her. Apparently after that, Mike Nichols was on coke the whole time too.
no, not Uncle Mike.
Yeah. I think that was in his new book that Mark Harris just wrote.
He just does not seem like the type.
Well, it was 88.
Man. Well, that's
nobody
true,
seems like the type.
Everybody was the type.
Yeah, totally.
Oh wow, that's crazy. It's a movie that sort of mirrored Melanie Griffith in some ways, like. I don't think she was taken very seriously as an actor at the time. She was overly sexualized. She really needed this job. And so many of those things sort of align with the character of Tess that it sort of makes sense and was perfectly cast. And I don't think she's known as like one of our great actors, but she was really great in this movie.
Lovely. And a sort of guileless. Is that what that word means?
I think so.
So yes, she's wonderful, and it's interesting about. I was thinking about the sex in the movie, that like how sexualized she was, and another thing that makes this movie unusual is that it's not clear who the audience is, if the audience is supposed to be men or women. Like,
right.
there are scenes where she's sexualized, but it's always sort of jokey. Like he buys her like this silly underwear to put on and she puts it on. And so it's not like a bombshell. It's sort of like, she looks like a dipshit a little bit.
Right.
And then there are scenes where Harrison Ford, he's taking off a shirt and you can tell that they just want that they want the audience to eat it up. So it's like there is a sort of parody to the way they sexualize people in this movie, which I really admire, and especially considering this is 88 when women were, I mean, you really had to put yourself out there as just a piece of sexual meat to be looked at as an actress in a lot of these movies, and the fact that that didn't quite happen for her says good things about Mike Nichols.
Yeah, it is an interesting movie in that way because it's making a statement about that sexualization. But like you said, I mean, I can't think of many movies that have more lingerie in them than this. She's got it in a couple of scenes. Sigourney Weaver is wearing lingerie in a couple of scenes. And Melanie Griffith is vacuuming in her underwear and no shirt in one scene. She says that was her idea. I think I read that she said that was her idea.
Really?
Yeah, and she said, you know, this is... She said it was because it was real, because like I wouldn't be doing that in my office suit. Like if no one's around, I would just take my clothes off and do it because that would make more sense.
Because you wouldn't get dirty. I just don't understand how you wear that sort of underwear, because it was sort of like the thing with the clips and stuff.
I don't even know.
Like that just, really? I don't even know what they call it. Like, I don't know. Lingerie is weird.
It is.
Tricks.
Oh, no. What do you mean? Like garter belts and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's garter belts. Right. It's like clips. Like the underwear clips. Clips doesn't make sense.
But this sort of is evidence in this one critic at the time. I read this article from, I think it was The Guardian at Working Girl at 30 from a few years ago. And it talks a bit about this sexualization and sort of the time. And in 1988, a male movie critic wrote, with her floozy face, her Cupid doll voice, her made-for-bed bod, and a general demeanor suggesting She was born already knowing the Kama Sutra by heart. Wow. It always comes as a surprise to audiences to find Melanie Griffith can actually act too.
Jesus.
Like, that's a mainstream movie critic.
That's so gross. And
it is so gross.
It is so gross, but it also disappoints me because to me, it feels like the movie gets past that.
I feel like it does too. And that's sort of the point.
And I felt like that's like you gotta be looking at things in a pretty flat way to have that be your takeaway about Melanie Griffith in that movie. I think.
No, I totally agree. It also kind of flips the script a little bit in that Harrison Ford's role is typically you would think of as like the woman's part in 1988. Yeah. He's sort of the cheerleader to her, and he's the one that's sexualized throughout the movie. In every scene, it feels like every woman in that movie has never seen a man before Harrison Ford walks into the room.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, it's clearly the point because it's so overblown.
Yeah.
And there's that one funny scene where he's changing his shirt in the office and all the women are watching through the blinds in the office and he turns around and sort of acknowledges them with that little sort of wry, almost bow, which was pretty funny.
Yeah. Incredible. Such good done with such good humor. There's something about sexuality when sexuality is presented in a way that's not just trying to give you a boner. I'm sorry if this is like, am I not supposed to curse?
No, you can say fucking boner and whatever. You
Oh, okay.
And garter belt.
Like very often you feel like you're watching a movie and they're trying to get you to feel sexed up. They're trying and like that's not the way that sexuality was sort of presented in this movie. It's sort of presented in the different forms and how people are reacting to it, and that's what it feels like to me. It feels more considered.
Yeah, I think so. And it was at a time sort of in that 80s turning point where, and the Guardian article kind of talked about this, when I think from the time Melanie Griffith was born, it was like 8% of mothers worked. And by the time she made this movie, it was like 50-something percent.
Wow.
And so it was a time when, you know, women were in the workforce more than ever before and you know, trying to get these jobs and like that Sigourney Weaver had. But she's also like, and I think they were right in doing this, played as having to sort of play the game as well, even in her position.
Yeah. I mean, that was also sort of like, and yes, I mean, Sigourney Weaver is a successful businesswoman, but she's beautiful.
Yeah.
And she
speaks right.
Yeah. And she uses her, you could tell, there's even a couple of scenes where she sort of intimates that like, she definitely flirts with the other male executive, but then they walk away and she says, what an asshole, that type stuff.
Right.
Like, but it is, it presents it all as a system that women now have to figure out how to navigate, as opposed to like maybe presented as a system that is not the way it should be.
Right.
So it presents it as like, well, women are trying to do this. So how are they going to, how are they going to figure this one out? And they do. And it, in a sort of, in a way that's true to the time. But it's not really sort of questioning the system on a larger level, as sort of archly as we might do it now.
Yeah. That's a really good point.
And does that sound right?
Yeah, it sounds totally right. And I think it like, it's shocking to see how little progress was made until 1988 and then how much has been made since then.
Yeah,
because it seems, I mean, it's like stuff straight out of the like 1950s almost with the Alec Baldwin character who this is. I love this era of Alec Baldwin, like young Alec Baldwin is so great.
Mm-hmm.
But when he basically says at the end, straight up, like, you know, why is it always about what you want? He's like, who died and made you Princess Grace or whatever, or Grace Kelly. Yeah. And it's like, dude, are you kidding me? It's like she walked in on you like banging her friend.
Yeah.
And he's like, why is it always about what you want? And it's like, is this 1988? Really?
But that's what she was. But it's also truthful. Like, we don't hear that as he's right. We hear that as like, this is what she's dealing with. And he's not wrong, but she's more right.
Right.
Like, he's not wrong for the time. He's a broken man in many ways.
Sure.
Like, but the fact that that's what somebody like her would have to be dealing with is the hoops that she has to jump through is incredible.
Yeah. And also just, you know, it wasn't like this was everybody. I mean, this was a working class guy from Staten Island yeah. where that sort of attitude was probably way more prevalent than the Manhattanites. Or maybe it was just disguised more as casual sexism. But like Harrison Ford is a pretty good guy. He doesn't take advantage of her.
Yeah.
I think that role needed to be, like, it was crucial for this movie to have one good dude in it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, for sure.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots as I sit down with inspiring women like Misty Copeland, Brooke Shields, Vanessa Hudgens, and so many more. We dive into how these women made their pivot and their mindset shifts that happened as a result. It's a podcast about women, their stories, and how their pivot became their success. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Every family has skeletons in their closet. Mine certainly does. Ones that go back 100 years and reach thousands of miles back to our hometown in Sicily. Ever since I can remember, my relatives told the story of my great-great-grandmother who was killed by the mafia. I'm Joe Piazza, and in my new podcast, I'm taking on a generational vendetta, visiting the scene of the crime, confronting mafia experts, tracking down Italian officials, and even consulting mediums to set the record straight on my great-great-grandmother's mysterious disappearance. And in between the fact-finding missions, I'll be drinking a lot of wine and eating all of the pasta. Come to Italy with me to solve this 100-year-old murder mystery. Listen to The Sicilian Inheritance on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm a big fan of movies where there are characters who are not to be underestimated. It's kind of a tropey character, but I always fall for it. It's just their stories I love, and this is definitely one of them. And I think this movie, if it were made today, it would be so much sillier than it is.
Yeah,
because it is sort of one of those, you know, sort of Three's Company-esque things with mistaken identities. And especially at the end when Harrison Ford comes in the apartment, she's hiding in the other room and people are overhearing the wrong conversations. But it always rises above that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why that is. I actually put a lot of that on Melanie Griffith. There's something about her. There's something about, then they're right about her voice. Like, she sort of puts on the silly, I don't even know what to put on. Like, her voice is a voice that one might not take seriously.
Yeah.
But there's something about, there is something, there's a non-seriousness to her voice, but there's not a silliness to her voice.
Right.
Like, she's not wacky.
Right.
Like, she sort of owns the space that she occupies in a way that you do take her seriously.
Yeah, this movie would be way over the top with silliness and wackiness, I think, if it were made today.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Sigourney Weaver, my God, just all those people.
Yeah, that character, I think they played it perfect because she was so hard to sort of read. Like, she was being her mentor, but you don't know for a little while if she's an ally or not.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not played as a straight up villain. That kind of comes later. So she's sort of the mentor, but a little bit condescending. And then, of course, you learn throughout the movie that she has taken her idea.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still not in a Disney villain way. It all feels very real still, I think.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
It's as far as storytelling goes, if you're someone who has ever written screenplays or tried to, this is a movie that I think could very easily be taught in classes as far as just kind of perfect structure.
Perfect.
It runs like a Swiss watch, but just very subtly, hitting those plot points like exactly where they should be. And I know Nichols didn't write the script. I looked up who it was. I can't find his name now, but just a really great lesson in structure, I think, for storytelling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it moves. And it also just like it feels like it feels complete, even in the way. And I'm sure this was in the writing. Maybe I'm sure this was in the directing, actually. Like, it starts the way it ends. Like,
right.
It starts with that helicopter shot going across the New York Harbor and into the, you know, into the streets, into the, wait, does it go to, oh no, it goes on to the Staten Island Ferry, yeah. Right? As they're going into the city to sort of pursue capitalism. And it ends, you know, as they're pursuing capitalism in a building, you know, in this helicopter shot that's pulling out.
Yeah.
And you just see how many people are doing what Melanie Griffiths is trying to do and
yeah.
how sort of futile it is. And then you are just like a cog in the machine, ultimately. Like, so it does have that, like, it is complete.
Yeah.
It is complete.
Yeah, it is complete. Harrison Ford should have done more comedies. I realized that when I was watching this today. He's very funny when he wants to be.
Sure is.
And this isn't a comedy. I mean, this is sort of a dramedy in some ways. It's not one that's plays for gags or for sort of easy jokes, but there's a lot of humor in it, and a lot of it comes from him and just how subtle he is in this movie. And his face acting is just so, I just love that guy so much. He's so lovable in this movie.
Yeah, well, there's also something about, and I don't know how fair this is, but I do think it's true. There's something about beautiful people being funny.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like when you see somebody really beautiful and then they start talking, you're like, oh, you're a genius as well.
Right.
It's almost like it's fun to watch these three characters because they're all so beautiful, and all the characters sort of have a certain, nobody's sort of necessarily the huge star. And so they're also beautiful. They're all good actors, but then you realize that they're all funny in their own way.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like, I don't know, that kind of thing makes me happy for the people in it. Like you like the people, you like the bad guys, you like the good guys. Like you just like that everybody is given enough to play with, as opposed to like a lot of movies where it's like you hire one star, you give them all the good lines and everybody else
right.
is just bouncing off them. This just feels like, look at all these guys, everybody's having such fun playing with these characters. That's how it feels to me.
Yeah, I agree. And there's just so much subtlety. Again, it would just be so different if this film were made today or maybe even back then in a different director's hands. One of the moments, one of the great little small moments is when he's in the bar with her when he first meets her and she doesn't know who he is. He mm-hmm. orders the tequila mm-hmm. and he goes, power to the people. And she almost under her breath says, the little people.
Yeah.
And he doesn't even notice she said it. It's like, it's a line for the audience.
Yeah.
And just little things like that, I think, separate this movie from sort of what was going on at the time.
Yeah. Do you feel like it's a capitalist movie or an anti-capitalist movie? I actually feel like, well, sorry, what do you think?
Well, I don't know, because it's, I mean, in the end, she got that job in mergers and acquisitions. And like, that's the happy, that's her Cinderella ending, is she got that job, not that she realized that life wasn't for her. I think that would have been anti-capitalism.
But then to me, the pullout shot at the end is what makes it all, is what turns it for me.
That she's
it's like
the
you realize, oh, she got her office, but you just realize she's one of a million.
Yeah,
and it just
that's
doesn't
true.
Fucking matter. That's what I get from that. Yeah.
Yeah. I never really thought about that. It's,
I also think it in a way gives, what I do like about it is that it very much could have made, a lot of it's like Staten Island's poor, Manhattan's rich.
Uh-huh.
Like it's sort of two worlds, and you don't finish the movie thinking I want to be one part of one and not the other. They both seem attractive to me at the end. The Staten Island life seems attractive. The wedding where they're all having fun,
yeah.
or like the engagement party, they're at the bar. Mick stowed this behind the bar. She gives him her briefcase, and everybody's just having fun, sort of drunk, And you don't get the sense that they're the ones who got it wrong and that the people in Manhattan got it right.
No, I agree.
Yeah. And so, and then the flip side, like you see the scenes in Manhattan, like the big fancy wedding, and like that all just seems kind of stupid, but yeah. it seems critical of it, but not in a way, they're just people in a big system too. So I like movies like that like it really sort of, it doesn't decide for you. Mm-hmm. It kind of makes both seem attractive and unattractive at the same time. I think that's a neat trick.
It is a neat trick, and there is some ambiguity there. And aside from the main characters, I think the more likable group is Joan Cusack and Alec Baldwin, yeah. And then the Staten Islanders.
Yeah, and the second, yeah, and they're you know, they're about friendship, and they, like, when Tess gets fired, like, they did a little collection and they hand her an envelope full of money so she can get drunk one
right.
day, and like they've got their eye, on what is important. But then I will say, even the, and I'm not sure how this serves my argument or sort of interrupts it, but like even like the big CEO type people, like Mr. Trask, that everybody's trying to, they don't make them seem evil either. They make them seem,
right.
it's almost like paternal, I guess, in a
yeah.
way, but it's not, I guess maybe that means it's not really going after any of them. It's about people navigating themselves in that system. It's less about a critique of the system itself, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it does subvert a lot of cliches. And for 1988, I mean, their movies are all about tropes and cliches still, but
yeah.
I feel like back then, this was a much smarter, more considered take on this stuff than what was normally going on, which is probably why it stood out. And was such a, you know, I mean, it was nominated for a bunch of Oscar awards, and
yeah.
It wasn't, you know, it could have very easily been sort of a schmaltzy little, you know, rom-com.
Yeah.
And he subverts that so many times, like their first kiss, you know, there's no music swelling. It's not, it yeah. was some great background. It's just after that meeting, he just, yeah. he's going down the stairs and he has the urge to kiss her.
Yeah.
And it just felt so real. And the same goes for when he tells her he loves her. It's not some big Hollywood moment. With this backdrop of the Manhattan skyline, it's just sort of there. And I feel like it's just much more real.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And also just like pairing all those moments up with these big sort of corporate moments.
Right.
Like of tension. Like he says, I love you, like right before the big meeting.
Right. Right?
And like, it is an interesting pairing. Yeah.
I did not see the twist coming, believe it or not. It's pretty telegraphed, but I did not realize, seeing it for the first time today at 50 years old, I did not see that Harrison Ford would have been dating Catherine this whole time. Maybe I'm a dummy.
I've seen it so many times that I don't know that I remember what my initial reactions were, but you actually didn't see it coming. So you were shocked.
I saw the fact that he had someone else in his life coming. But I was definitely surprised that it was Sigourney Weaver, because I guess I thought he had been in her office, so he would have known. But you know, maybe it was a different office or something. They never really explained that.
Well, she had just started at Penny Marsh.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So well, there you have
I
it.
I just want to make sure that you don't make people think that there's holes in this plot, because there's
all
not.
Right, it's seamless.
Airtight.
No, yeah, yeah. I mean, I didn't see it coming, and I thought it was a good twist. And
yeah,
that little Three's Company scene in there where they're in different rooms, you know.
Yeah.
I like that scene because it's she gets that little bit of validation she needs when she overhears him clearly not really into her.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of movies would have kept her in that feeling of being unsure about herself.
Yeah.
And I like that she had that little moment.
Yeah. No, that's true.
I love the stuffed gorilla.
Amazing. Yeah.
Because that wasn't played up. It was just a funny little weird choice.
Yeah.
Again, if that were made today, that would have been so slapstick and weird.
Totally. All these weird choices, like in the cocktail party where she's serving Chinese dumplings
right.
in a steam car and the steam's like blowing in her face. It's just like there's no reason for it, but it's just a great like indignity.
Yeah.
That was her idea, the Chinese dumplings. Like,
right.
And her idea, like she didn't really think it through, but yeah. And so they're great sort of physical bits, or like the cast is an amazing, there's no reason for her to have a, like that big old cast
right.
on Sigourney Weaver. And he comes in and he knocks on it. Like
right.
he's a 12-year-old, like, look at this. And then it makes her so hilarious that she's trying to walk with dignity with this cast. Like, man, it's just like, it's one of those things you feel sometimes you can watch it and just be excited for the screenwriter that they like figured out this plot device,
right?
And that you could see how it played. Like, maybe she gets into a skiing accident. No, but then she's got the cast on. No, that'll be really funny in this scene.
Right.
And it's just like, it's just one of those things that keeps on giving. It's not just like a one-time bit.
Yeah. The giant tiki drinks at the wedding that Harrison Ford sucks down. It's like there's just enough of those sort of standard comedy moments without it veering too much into that territory, I think.
Yeah.
And again, he plays it so funny in that bathroom scene when the bride walks in and he comes out. It's just, that sort of classic Hollywood comedy stuff,
Yeah.
Like there's a guy in the ladies' bathroom, but it doesn't ever feel silly to me.
Yeah. What is that?
I think it's probably Mike Nichols.
Yeah.
And, the acting, everyone pulled it together, but I don't think he allowed it to veer into that territory.
Right.
Such a deft hand. And then, then that ending with them in the apartment and he's bought her this lunchbox and it's like, you're dead inside if you're not just like dying at that moment when he packs her little lunch. It's just, it's so perfect. And he's such a good dude. And like, you don't have a heart if that doesn't, at least make you like well up a little bit.
Yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Packs her little
lunch.
It's
a combination of the two worlds. It's like the sort of Manhattan world combined with the sort of like human connection of the Staten Island world. Like that I think that's what it's presenting as this is what matters.
Because she would be certainly packing Alec Baldwin's lunch.
Yeah. Totally.
If her life had gone that way.
And he's rooting. Yeah. He's rooting for her.
Yeah.
He's supporting her. In this incredibly, which now all you want to do is say in this incredibly fucked up system where she's got to like go be an ass, but somehow I don't get hung up on that still. I don't get hung up on that. Sometimes when you see movies 30 years later, you're like, oh, that was a blind spot. There's something about it that seems good natured enough that you don't sort of judge it for the things it misses because times have changed, if that makes any sense. Like zero black people in the movie.
Right.
Like it's just not
for sure.
Like it doesn't address any of those sorts of issues. But perhaps a person of color who's watching this movie might say it differently, but I don't know. I think it deals enough with class that it makes you root for people of different classes enough that, I don't know, there's something about it that holds up even despite its sort of its blind spots.
Yeah. I guess if, the true like anti-capitalist message would be if she realized that world wasn't for her and she started up her own small boutique firm that did things differently and she wasn't part of the machine or something like that. But, this felt true to 1988 to be sure.
Yeah. But also just like incredibly, like when she realizes at the end that she's got her own office and like, this is her secretary. And then she says, here's what, maybe now is a good time to talk about what you expected.
Yeah. That was a nice moment.
She's like, and she just says like, well, first of all, don't you call me Tess. Uh-huh. You don't have to get me coffee unless you're getting some for yourself.
Yeah.
And the rest we'll just figure out as we go along.
Yeah.
Like it shows like, this is how gender, which is a very actually modern message, right?
Yeah.
Like this is how women in the workplace or women in the upper positions would actually change how it is for everybody. It's not just sort of like a filling a slot with a woman. It's like it will change the way that we work.
Yeah. And I think it was a message of hope for 1988 for women.
Yeah.
I think this is a movie that in 1988 women probably really, really loved. Like you were talking about who is the audience. I don't necessarily think it was just for women, but I think it is a movie that women probably could rally around a little bit.
Yeah.
Like they could rally around a Thelma and Louise or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got the Carly Simon song.
Yeah.
Which is, it's such a great song. It was such a big hit.
Big drums. Yeah.
Yeah. Those big drums, that big 80s production. And it also did this thing that I feel like movies really used to do a lot, which I love, which is you have a theme song that is also sort of the score of the entire movie too.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it when movies did that, and they just don't. I don't feel like they do that anymore.
Like the Die Hard thing, isn't that didn't Die Hard do that?
No, I don't think
Die Hard was all Beethoven's Ninth, right?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, like a theme song that a pop star sings, And then it's rearranged as the score throughout the movie, too.
Let the River Run
is in this entire movie kind of from front to back. And then she, you know, it opens the movie, it closes the movie, and then it's the score
right.
in between.
It's like the underscore. Right. You're absolutely right.
It's great, though.
And she's like, sometimes Carly Simon's just sort of humming in the background.
Right.
Yeah. You're right.
I really loved it, though. I appreciate, sometimes, like, I appreciate a pick from a guest. For some weird reason, if that makes sense. Like, I love that this is your movie pick, Working Girl from 1988. It was a big movie that people love, but I don't know. It just, it seemed like an unlikely choice. And
what's everybody else picking?
I mean, it kind of varies from like stuff that people like their favorite movies when they were kids, the first big movies, to stuff that's a little more heady that they, you know, as adults, I think really got into. But I don't know. I feel like this is a pick from the heart and I appreciate that.
Oh, it really is. I really love it. And I love talking about it, man. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks for being here. Where can people find you? You're on Twitter and stuff?
D. Tabersky on Twitter. Okay. And, you know, iTunes, podcasts, Apple Podcasts, all those places, Spotify. Just search my name.
Yeah.
My
stuff. Go listen to all the shows. I'm going to check out the cop show starting this week. And I'll probably email you. That'll be my new obsession for the next week.
Good. If you ever want to talk about cops, let me know. That or Richard Simmons, I will talk about both.
I probably will. All right. Yeah, right. Thanks, Dan.
Movie Crush is produced and written by Charles Bryant and Noel Brown, edited and engineered by Seth Nicholas Johnson, and scored by Noel Brown here in our home studio at Ponce City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Diosa.
And I'm Mala.
We are the creators of Locatora Radio, a radiophonic novela, which is a fancy way of saying
a podcast. Welcome to Locatora Radio Season 9.
Love at first listen.
This season, we're falling in love with podcasting all over again.
With new segments, correspondence, and a new sound.
Listen to Locatora Radio as part of the Michael Dura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.